is the Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, June 9th, 1999. Senator Charles Power, Chair.
Convene the Committee on Rules and Elections, the Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2271. Mike Dewey, Brian Bowe, Sandy Fletcher.
I know he changed the guest to know the decision that he needs to do this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. This is the infamous pool attachment legislation, House Bill 2271, which comes to you as a compromise between the owners of the poles, utility poles, and the pole users. It deals with, in our opinion, the escalating pole rates and, on the other side, unauthorized attachments to utility poles. Let me go through the compromise briefly and tell you what's in the bill. First of all, non-investor-held utilities, PUDs, co-ops, municipalities would be subject to the jurisdiction of the PUC when there is a complaint over terms and conditions regarding pole usage. We have, and I think the others would agree, that they believe that they were included, the PUDs and the co-ops and municipalities, in the law. Originally, a PUC hearings officer opined differently, and it's unclear, and therefore we thought it would be important to put it in the statute and make it very, very clear. The bill addresses the question of unauthorized attachments on utility poles by requiring authorization in contracts, and I do want to make it clear that this does not impact franchises. The City of Portland was concerned about franchises with those in the easements, and it does not impact franchises in any way. When the pole user is compliant with the contract, there is an opportunity to have a lower rate, which gets closer to the FCC formula. And one of the reasons we wanted to move in this direction is to find a way to get a more equitable rate based upon the FCC formula. It doesn't get us there entirely, but it gets us there halfway. So that is in the legislation. But you must be in compliance. You must be compliant with the full contract. And lastly, and very important to us, and I think the others, because of the concern over the number of users who are making application to be on utility poles, there is a provision for a task force set up by the PUC, by the owners and users, to go through the various issues that are addressed in this particular bill involving inspections, fees, and the like. And we think this is very important because we need to have better communications amongst the owners of the poles and the users, and this will set that up. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Hopefully I've been able to describe adequately what's in House Bill 2271, and we do support the legislation.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this morning representing Portland General Electric. And I won't reiterate what Mike has done a good job of describing the bill, only to say that our original preference was to let these matters be handled solely by the Public Utilities Commission, but we are willing to work within the framework of House Bill 2271. We do believe the task force is an important component, and we do believe the bill is in the first step in moving us towards resolving these outstanding problems regarding utility pole attachments. I do want to add one thing for the record. As Mike indicated, there were some concerns on behalf of the cities that the provisions of this bill might in some way result in new fees for municipalities. That is not the intent of the legislation. We do not intend or foresee this legislation creating any new fees on municipalities in regard to utility pole attachments, and they ask that we make that explicit in the record, and I'm doing so at this time.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Just wanted to make a couple of comments. First of all, as Mike testified, on the fact that consumer-owned utilities are now specifically included under the jurisdiction of the PUC in regards to pole attachment. We totally concur with. That was our understanding all along, and so this clarification in statute is acceptable to us. Secondly, I want to restate what Mr. Bowe just said, and that is that we came into the session with a concern about the very high level of noncompliance and wanted to address that this session. We're anxious to have the opportunity to go to the PUC to discuss the issues in that forum on pole attachments, because there are many and they are varied. They go beyond the rental fee issue. And so we do also very much support the opportunity to go to the PUC. And also for the record, I just want to clarify that the rental space reduction for safety clearance is only when and if they are in compliance. I think as you read House Bill 2271, I was a little concerned that that wasn't as clear as it should be, so I wanted to make sure that I testified and got that on the record, that there is a definite link between a rental reduction and compliance with the contract. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Chair, before we vote on this, I do want to clarify potential conflict in that I do represent a cable company in my private practice. But I also have two co-ops in my team.
Never did the co-ops.
No, thank you.
Are there other schools in the No. Municipal utilities and the telcos are all okay with this also?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I'm here representing the consumer-owned utilities. We did have a coalition of electric that are all in the same position, but I certainly don't speak for the other telecommunications utilities. But if they're nodding back there, then...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is anyone else desiring to testify on the bill? Not we close public hearing, open work session on House Bill 2271.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I'd move House Bill 2271 to the floor with the passed.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2271 to the floor with a passed recommendation. Any further discussion? The clerk call the roll.
Senator Beyer.
Aye.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Cordy.
Yes.
Senator Clark.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 2271 moved the floor with a two pass recommendation. Senator Bryant, would you carry?
I might be happy to.
Senator Bryant will carry House Bill 2271.
Thank you.
We're going to go back to the head of the agenda now, folks, and take up public hearing on House Bill 3616. Ask the committee administrator to describe where we are with testimony and amendments.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3616 allows remedial action to include excavation and off-site disposal for certain hotspot areas with contamination. The site that is in the focus of this morning's discussion is the Chem Waste site in Arlington, Oregon. We have -A3 amendments that we looked at last time we met on this bill. They do two things. They have an emergency clause, and they authorize DEQ to allow a recycling operation at a hazardous waste or PCB treatment facility. We have before us also this morning -A5 amendments that require DEQ to, when selecting a remedial action or remedial plan, they have to take into account the method and distance for transportation of the contamination to available disposal facilities. The -A5 amendments speak to section one of the bill. There were two sections that were in dispute between the parties last time. The -A5 take care of, according to both sides, take care of the potential constitutional problems in section one. Section four of the bill is still in dispute as far as it concerns its constitutionality.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Right.
On the constitutional issues, I was provided a memo from the Perkins Coie law firm dealing with that, and I asked legislative counsel to review it, and they advised me today just verbally, because I didn't get it so soon enough for them to give us a written opinion, but Jeanette Holman said that the Dash A5 amendments take care of the constitutional issues as it relates to Section 1. And legislative counsel's feeling is that the issues raised concerning the constitutionality of Section 4, they think that it is constitutional and wouldn't need amendment. So that was the informal opinion from legislative counsel at 8:05 this morning.
Call Dave Barros and Don Higginson. We've got a big agenda this morning, folks, so if you can be brief, I'd appreciate it.
We will be briefed to a fault, Mr. Chairman. Dave Barros, Chemical Waste Management, with me, Don Higginson, legal counsel for the company here in Oregon. As Brian indicated, we are the facility at Arlington, Oregon, that handles hazardous waste. Brian has said it perfectly. The A3 amendments, the Dash 3 amendments, which we discussed with you last time, we would be very grateful if the committee would add those. You've already set the fee for this kind of waste that's discussed in the A3 amendment by the passage of House Bill 2800 on the floor 2 days ago, on the Senate floor 2 days ago. The Dash 5 amendments are an effort that Mr. Higginson and others have brought to you that do, I believe, fix the constitutional question in Section 1, as Senator Bryan has indicated. All parties subscribe to that, those amendments. So we would hope that you would adopt the A5 also, the A3 and the A5. And as to Section 4, Mr. Higginson has done an analysis of the constitutional question involved in that and has come to the conclusion that it does not, that section does not fail the constitutional test. Larry Edelman, the legal counsel for the DEQ, has come to the same conclusion as has, as Senator Bryan indicated, Jeanette Holman from Legislative Counsel. So the only folks that still believe there's a constitutional problem are the ones who raise it, and that's the facility in Boise, ESI, and I believe they're signed up, and they'll probably explain to you what. Our hopes is you adopt Dash 3, Dash 5, send the bill to the floor, and leave Section 4 as is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
This is a legal analysis.
Thank you very much. Call Jim Witte, Steve Kapori, Ty Wyman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Witte representing Enviro State of Idaho. We raised a constitutional question with the Dash 3 amendments, and I haven't really seen the Dash 4. So with me, Ty Wyman and Paul Garahan, representing EnviroSafe as well, two lawyers, and they should be the ones to describe the legal issue. I think what we have here is that if the Dash 3s, as presented earlier, are adopted the way they are, we believe that we're jumping into a legal morass. We have a way out for the committee, and we'd like to describe that. So. Is it Ty that starts on?
No, go ahead. excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ty Wyman for EnviroSafe Services of Idaho. My address is 1211 Southwest 5th, Suite 1500, Portland 97204. I want to stress that the bill is generally fine. As Jim has stated, it does retain a minor constitutional flaw. And I'd like to give just a brief background. The federal constitution basically prohibits the state from discriminating against out-of-state businesses. And Section 4 of the bill still does just that. It disfavors out-of-state business in the public bidding process by allowing sort of a subtractor for DEQ fees, which would otherwise be payable by in-state bidders. Now, the constitutional rule does have an exception, and that occurs where the state is simply participating in the markets and essentially as a business entity itself. Council believes that Section 4 fits within that exception because the state would simply administer the contract, but we take a contrary view based upon a look at the real source of funding here, and that's the key issue which we would like to raise for you. The cases are fairly clear that where non-public money is the source of funding for the contract, the constitutional problem remains. And so where the state would seek cost recovery against private parties responsible for the waste, you've got the constitutional problem. Now, to be frank, I think we would all agree that the specific question has not been resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not going to be resolved today. The real question is what we can do to the bill to avoid the question. Our alternative language is frankly relatively simple. It simply clarify that this allowance for an artificial subtraction for in-state bidders would not be allowed where the state would retain its ability to seek cost recovery. That is, where the state would maintain its ability to go to a private source to essentially pay for the contract, then it's simply a matter that this artificial subtractor put into the public bidding for the waste disposal services could not be used. Again, that language has been submitted with our memorandum, which I hope that you have, and with that, I leave it to questions.
Questions? Well, what's the dollar amount we're talking about? If you could just give me a ballpark figure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, you're talking about of waste in the state?
No,
of the, what you described as the artificial subtractor. What's the dollar implication?
Well, for a given, you're talking about the rate. I believe Bob Danko of DEQ is here, and he can be more precise than we can on that. So I think we can get the answer for you here.
I would note, if I may, Senator Bryant, that the cases are also very clear that the amount in question is irrelevant to the...
Well, I understand that. Well, I'm just curious about what dollars are we talking.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I would hope that you have the amendment before you. We have copies. I'm not sure if you do.
What amendment are we talking about?
We add a sentence to the bottom of section, the proposed section 4, and I believe the dash 3. And this amendment would do what Taiwan just described.
Thank you.
Yeah, I apologize for assuming that the amendment was before AZC. It is really relatively simple, and it's a simple way to clarify an issue which is something of a little bit more asked.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Bob Danko.
Good morning, Mr. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to state for the record that we support the Dash 3 or the Dash 5 amendments, and we oppose the Dash 4 amendments. I believe the Dash 4 amendments. The sentence that would require us to declare that we would not seek cost recovery goes against other state law and the strong direction we've had from the legislature to actually, you know, make the person responsible for the contamination, if at all possible, pay for the cost. So we would not in any way want to declare before we knew that there was a potential for cost recovery to say that we would not cost recover.
What he did.
Further questions? I have a question just generally. What dollar amount are we talking about?
Well, we're talking the fee that the department gets on each ton of waste disposed at the chem waste facility for cleanup waste, and that's what we're talking about here, is $20 per ton. In the past, there hasn't been a big amount of money until recently when we were doing a major Superfund cleanup in North Portland, and the amount that would have come to the department in these fees would have been exceeded $500,000. And because we didn't have this the system in place that this bill is providing, we lost that income. And so it hasn't been big money in the past, but there is this one instance where it was, and there could be other examples in the future. It's an important fix for us.
And the reason you couldn't have charged it under existing law?
The state law right now does not allow us to do that, and our contracting attorneys, we look through state law very in a detailed manner to see if we could, but the problem is there is nothing in state law that would allow us to exclude the money we get back when we go to bid. So even though we know we're going to get that money back, there's nothing there that allowed us to include that. And what this language does, it allows us to include that, so then we can look at what we think of as the net cost to the department for doing a cleanup. And we think that's good public policy.
Any further questions?
Oh, yeah.
Senator, for Dash 5 to go, I see you went back and forth, 3-4, which would be no issue, which is which?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, I'm sorry. Yes, I know which is which. The Dash 3s are we support the Dash 3s. It's the Dash 4s, I believe, are the ones that would limit our ability to seek cost recovery.
Thank you. And Senator Courtney, we don't have any official Dash 4s before us, but the language that Enviro State just handed out, that's what I think is being referred to as the Dash 4.
That's my understanding.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. Close public hearing on House Bill 3616, or work session on House Bill 3616.
Move the Dash 3 amendments.
Senator Courtney has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3616. Any objections?
Not so ordered. Move the Dash 5 amendments.
Senator Courtney has moved the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3616. Any objections?
Not short. Move House Bill 3616 is amended forward to pass.
Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 3616 to the floor with, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Not clerk, call the roll.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Bryan?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. House Bill 3616 as amended is moved to the floor with due pass recommendation. Senator Courtney, would you?
I'll do my duty.
Carry that bill for us, please. Thank you, sir. With that, we're going to close that work session, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1110. We have Mr. Leitner signed up. Please.
Here we go again.
Senator Ferrioli, there's written testimony, which I don't see. Is that the one?
Yes, it is.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Al Leitner. I'm with the Department of Transportation for Right-of-Ways. Very briefly, Senate Bill 110, as we read it, would require an agency to notify a property owner of the agency's intent to acquire real property prior to disclosing that intent to any other person or other agency, and also any agency acquiring property is also required to disclose to the seller at the time of property purchase of any negotiations to resell, exchange, or transfer property, including price and terms. The latter part, when we get involved with public works projects, is maybe where I should start. And there are a number of requirements, federal and state, that we have for public disclosure, public hearings, environmental documents that show corridors considered, corridors selected. The Transportation Commission passes a resolution that authorizes us to acquire property. These are all done in a public forum and happen prior to us being able to even know who we're going to approach to say, we are here to acquire a portion of your property. So the first part of the bill would cause us some problems in trying to figure out for a public works project how we would notify the owner before anyone else.
Sure. Senator Courtney, so quickly tell me when you say first part of the bill, would you go to the bill, please, sir, and tell me what you mean by first part, because I'm sort of a doofus. I don't understand.
Okay.
That's all I want to know, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I'm not able to find a copy of it.
I found a copy of the bill here. Over here.
He just
found his copy.
I guess. Under section 2, sub 2, is the portion that would be,
entire portion?
Yeah, sub 2, section 2, would be virtually impossible for us to figure out a way to let a person know we're going to acquire their property before the public at large would know it virtually at the same time, just by the process we go through. I believe sub 3, is perfectly fine.
Okay.
I don't see why we wouldn't disclose that. I believe that we would if that were planned. So I just wanted to point out that there is a potential conflict, at least with our public works process, project process, and wanted to make the committee aware of that.
Can you describe a situation where the state might be purchasing property with the intent to resell it to somebody else?
I have a difficult time seeing how that would happen, although I do know we have been involved in joint projects with other agencies where I have encountered properties that have been acquired by a nonprofit organization prior to us having gotten there, and I wondered how they acquired that, knowing that we would be there, and so I'm sensing that maybe that's part of this, but I'm not sure how that would work. Nonprofit.
I don't know whether it's true or not.
Thank you, Bart.
I know in the case of the situation that comes to mind is a low-income vaccine. In a lot of cases, local governments will work through a where they will purchase a piece of property with the full intent of transferring it to the housing authority or something like that. Does the state get involved in that?
Sure, sir. Senator Barb, I can only speak to the public works project that we do, the highway things. I'm just not sure what all the different possibilities exist in this.
And we're talking, Mr. Chair, from Fitness, this bill looks to me like it's not talking about a condemnation process, but rather just a free at-market sale.
Senator Starr, Senator Byer, that's probably true.
I'm searching for a problem.
Well, Senator Courtney and I just asked the same question without Senator Ferriola here. We don't know what the problem is.
Mr. Senator Ferriola's office is bringing down written testimony from him. So perhaps that will explain it for you.
I think I can shed some light. Within our state and across the nation, nonprofits have purchased property and resold it to the state for many times, in some cases, the purchase price as a simultaneous sort of transaction. And this usually involves an area that would be designated as a wildlife preserve, perhaps. Areas that were purchased by a nonprofit.
I believe that we would if that were planned. Because I just wanted to point out that there is a potential conflict, at least with our public works process, project process, and wanted to make the committee aware of that.
Just a question, Mr. Bauer. Can you describe the situation where the state might be purchasing property with the intent to resell it to somebody else?
I have a difficult time seeing how that would happen, although I do know we have been involved in joint projects with other agencies where I have encountered properties that have been acquired by a nonprofit organization prior to us having gotten there, and I wondered how they acquired that, knowing we would be there. And so I'm sensing that maybe that's part of this, and I'm not sure how that would work. Nonprofit.
The situation comes to mind is a low-income property. In a lot of cases, local governments will work through where they will purchase a piece of property with full intent of transferring it to the housing authority or something like that. Does the state get involved in that?
Sure, sir. Senator Byer, I can only speak to the public works project that we do, the highway things. I'm just not sure what all the different possibilities exist in this.
And we're talking, Mr. Chief, this bill looks to me like it's not talking about a condemnation process, but rather just a free at-market sale.
Senator Starr, Senator Byer, that's probably true.
I'm searching for a problem.
Well, Senator Courtney and I just asked the same question without Senator Ferriola here. We don't know what the problem is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferriola's office is bringing down written testimony from him. So perhaps that will explain it for you.
I think I can shed some light. Within our state and across the nation, nonprofits have purchased property and resold it to the state for many times, in some cases, the purchase price as a simultaneous sort of transaction. And this usually involves an area that would be designated as a wildlife preserve, perhaps. Areas that were purchased by a nonprofit to be transferred to Parks Department or to other departments of state government.
This doesn't address this. That would
I think it fails to address it in the way that was intended. And we do have.
That would speak more to the, I suppose, the public's right to be notified by the state of its intent to purchase property, not so much the individual property owner.
I think this is the issue that I raised with what he's addressing here.
I don't think this accomplishes his purpose.
I don't believe it does either.
Since we have the gentleman from ODOT here, is ODOT disclosed in public fashion when you're buying property before the purchase price, or?
Chair Star Center buyer, we don't publicly disclose individual negotiations. It's public knowledge that we're going to initiate them, but we do not disclose value and those sorts of things, except with the owner and their attorney, obviously.
Is a negotiated sale subject to public review before it's consummated?
Chair Star Center buyer, no, it is not.
What happens in that situation is ODOT sends a letter with an appraisal saying this is what we'll offer to pay for your property and why. And then the property owner can say yay, nay, and negotiate or get their own appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't like the price, they go through a condemnation trial and have a jury determine what it is. The jury, or the trial, of course, is public. But up until that time, the negotiations are private, probably not so much at the request of ODOT as it is at the request of the property owners, because they don't necessarily want to know what the world will want to know what they're trying to sell property.
I think that one of the issues is up there, and I don't know of any instances with the state, but I know an instance in my community where a neighboring city was trying to buy a piece of real estate, an office building, and it floated out there, and the price got bid up by a competing private owner who turned around and leased it to the city. Mississippi ended up paying in lease payments about $500,000 more than they would have if they could have consummated the sale.
That's another reason. I think what Senator Early is trying to do is it would be more directed at, say, the Parks Division, that the National Conservancy would buy a ranch and say, we'll give it to the state of Oregon for a wildlife refuge. And that takes it off the tax roll for a county, which can be detrimental to the rural counties, where they don't have a lot on the tax rolls anyway. But probably subparagraph 3 of 2 would accomplish parts of that. But what Senator Shirley really needs in the drafting of this is something specific that is dealing with if the state is entering into negotiations with a nonprofit to buy a piece of property, that needs to be disclosed in some public forum before, you know, the offer is made.
Senator Courtney, I just ask you a question. Do you have a list when you contact, you've been contacting YMCA's Boys and Girls Club and obviously this? Have you been doing that?
Senator Starr, Senator Courtney, no. Unless we have to acquire property from them for a project order.
If you want to pay you, the best you know, the best you can do, the extent you can represent where ODOT is going to be on this, they do not hate them in the fact that you run around with any nonprofit you can get your hands on to go in there and act as a middle person to purchase some land that you might then come in and there's another price.
Senator Starr, Senator Courtney, no.
Yeah, I really find this a fascinating judge. I need to know who's doing this. And I've read his testimony here, and I'd like to know what's going on. And I want to know projects that are going on. I want to know specific situations where this is going on.
I know of one a couple of years ago in Eastern Oregon. I don't know what county, but it was a large ranch that was going to be purchased, but then turned over to Red Edward Park. It was going to be purchased privately by a nonprofit and then turned into a wildlife reserve. And Representative Bob Smith was able to stop the deal by telling the Forest Service, the BLM, you will not accept this property. And this is given to you. And that's the only collateral or anecdotal story I can give you. But my suggestion would be deleting Section 2 of subparagraph, or subparagraph 2 of Section 2, because I don't think there's any problem. If you are in negotiations with the 91st, she should disclose that.
Well, I want to be really careful here. Suppose this nonprofit and this client is selling, they're in an agreement, there's a seller man or whatever. A year later, then, the nonprofit, for whatever reason, wants to get rid of the property, and they go to the state agency. Is that wrong?
The difficulty is, if it takes it off the tax rolls, then that's off the tax rolls anyway, because it's with a nonprofit. It's not necessary. And they may not be exempt from real property tax.
Well, but even if it does, if the nonprofit wants to go, you're telling me that they have to meet, public interest meet, they shouldn't be allowed to buy it. They were not involved. They were not, I said a year later, this was not a shell game. You're saying they should be able to buy that, they should be able to do that, huh?
I don't know. But I'm saying you got to get some consideration to the impact we have on the county if that's suddenly going off the tax roll.
This is not the concern that Senator Farioli is attempting to address. The concern he's attempting to address is where the property is essentially sold in a simultaneous sale for many times the dollar amount the owner received to the state by the nonprofit. And it's occurred, and it is on the record, and I'm pretty sure that Senator Farioli can bring us that record.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Barr.
I guess I'm pretty clear on how it happens with a condemnation. You can't pay more than the appraised value within some degrees of change. But isn't that standard policy anyway? The government agency is not allowed to buy property for substantially more than its appraised value?
Chair Starr, Senator Beyer, I'm not aware that that would be the case.
Have you already used the same effect?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Senator Farioli if he desires to further develop this. He's going to have to go back to Legislative Council and clarify his intent with the bill. With that, I'm closing the public hearing. We'll not have a work session on Senate Bill 1110. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 855. We have remember, this is Augustine Scott, and we have some new amendments.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Barrows representing AK Media. With me is Mr. Joe Willis, legal counsel for AK Media in the state of Oregon. You'll recall this, you hopefully will recall this bill, this deals with outdoor advertising. We discussed with the committee at the hearing the issue of the constitutional problem that was pending in the Oregon Supreme Court, and the committee expressed some strong interest in trying to fix that, and that has been done, and that is contained in both the Dash 5 and the Dash 6 amendments. The industry has agreed to drop out of all of the definitional changes dealing with issues like spacing, visibility, et cetera, Mr. Chairman. with the understanding and the discussions that we've had with DOT, Oregon DOT, that we will sit down in the interim and work on these issues and try to come up with some consensus that we can bring back to the 01 legislature. So we're in agreement with taking all that out of the bill. The one difference between the Dash 5 and the Dash 6 amendments, and I've discussed this with you, all of you, and that is that Dash 6 amendments permit tri-vision signs. And to just quickly refresh the committee's memory, 35 other states have gone into this direction, permit tri-vision signs. Oregon is kind of at the end of the train, as it were. And at the bottom of page 7 of the Dash 6 amendments, Mr. Chairman, it talks about a tri-vision sign if allowed by the United States Department of Transportation. And I hope that addresses Mr. Leitner's concern from ODOT, who said accurately that the current agreement that the state has with the Federal Highway Administration doesn't permit tri-vision signs. So a new agreement would have to be negotiated before tri-vision signs could actually go online. So I think this is pretty tight language, and we would urge, Mr. Chairman, the Dash 6 amendments as opposed to the Dash 5. But we certainly urge you to do one or the other.
Fair to court.
Okay.
Can we get Mr. Leitner up here, please?
Or Joan, whoever.
We have Mr. Leitner.
Yeah. Signed up.
You know what I'm going to ask? What's going on here is, I thought we discussed the fact that, in your opinion, a tri-vision sign would take the place of three signs. Is that correct?
You're asking me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, it is my belief that the industry would support, and I only speak for AK Media, so I can't speak for the other end, but that if a tri-vision sign were erected, that the current number of permits that the company holds in the bank, as it were, with three permits would come out of the bank as a result of that tri-vision sign.
Mr. Leitner, you just heard that. You want to respond since you seem to... You know what I'm talking about. I'm not surprising you.
But in the Senator Bryan knows what I'm talking about, so it's the chair.
Could you respond to what Dave Burroughs just said?
Chair Starr, Senator Courtney... I would be willing to agree to that if the definition of tri-vision said that each tri-vision sign or multi-message sign is subject to multiple permit fees and multiple permits being issued for each sign message displayed. Yes, I would. However, Federal Highway, and I have a letter here for the record that I'll give to the committee, says that, you know, we keep saying, well, Oregon and Washington ought to be treated the same. We're neighbors, and Washington can do it. Why can't we in Oregon? Federal Highway Administration and Department of Transportation out of Washington, D.C., indicate that some federal and state agreements expressly prohibit signs of moving parts, and which would preclude tri-vision. Other agreements are not as unequivocal and must be interpreted in the context of their state court decisions or customary uses. It goes on to say, the Oregon agreement falls into the first category. A sign with moving parts is not permitted in Oregon. And Washington's agreement, in contrast, does not address the moving parts issue and therefore would be subject to its customary uses and for its own courts to decide. So there's the difference, and there's why we may not be able to renegotiate our agreement with Federal Highway as easily as it's portrayed.
Well, it's not.
But I would be willing to support that.
You understand? That's not really the question I asked. That I understand this federal, state, will, feds allow us to do it, or the language that's the language that Dave Burroughs has referred to. I asked another question, not to make noise like a lawyer. He made a statement. They've got so many in the bank. When they put a tri-vision sign up, assuming it's allowed by all the gods, that, in effect, that there goes three permits. That's the issue I want spoken to, or in some way
Maybe if I just did a record here, it doesn't get it done. We need more language. Nate said they do want, his client will agree to that. And I suppose, now I'm looking more for that than whether the Fed, the gods, the federal gods are going to allow us tri-vision or this conflict that we got trying to, I'm not, that's...
Chair Starr, Senator Courtney, I believe the law has to reflect that that sign would absorb three permits. Otherwise, I don't believe it would work that way.
He is... expressly said that if the law reflected that, he would accept that. And we don't really have time to monkey with the Senate bill to solve that problem. I'd like to move the bill and allow them to make the amendment.
Is that the language?
We don't really have the prerogative to add the language with
another committee.
Well, we're not supposed to do it.
Wouldn't it? What'll happen? The practical matter is, it's got to go to the House. And by saying on line 23 at page 10, if applicable federal requirements are met, this would seem to say is that, and it says the Transportation Department may adopt rules. As I read this. If the federal government says no, it doesn't happen.
That's correct.
So it still requires that negotiation that Mr. Leitner's talked about. And right.
The part that's not in the statutes or in the bill is saying that the tri-vision sign would represent three signs as far as...
Chair, sir, that's correct. That would be on page 6, lines 7 through 14. There'd have to be an addition to that that would talk about each display surface being subject to a separate permit.
If we pass this as is, where do you see that in an agreement that we could work together to make the change, small correction in the House?
Mr. Chairman, Dave Barrows for the record. Certainly AK Media would pledge to do that, and that is our intent, and we can, I think, craft some language that would hopefully be tight enough to satisfy Mr. Leitner. Outdoor Systems and Media Art are here and can speak for themselves, but for our clients, we'd be willing to work with them. I mean, we've all just seen this language this morning, and that's just a function of the way the process is working right now. I would hope, Mr. Chairman, you do what you have indicated you want to do, move it along with the absolute assurance that we will work this hard on the House side and get and finish this last piece.
This is kind of ours.
Still the chair's intent to hold an afternoon meeting?
I don't know what the heck you guys are doing. Yes, we have a full schedule for our afternoon meeting.
If the four of us are in agreement of that, for that sentence, that each sign or surface will constitute one permit, why don't we, if you're unwilling to just add the language now, which I would feel comfortable with, why don't we just post it for this afternoon, carry it over, continue it to this afternoon's meeting, allow an amendment to be drafted, and we can do that. And we can get it done here, and we all feel comfortable with the bill going to the floor.
Well, discuss the committee what you've heard the proposal from Senator Barr. Would you be more comfortable doing it that way rather than moving the bill with the dash 6 amendments?
I'd be more comfortable. I'm not trying to do it for any sorry, but I'm just...
All right, we'll do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can I have the authority to get a loan with the
Senate? I guess the reason I'll change is to make sure that we're
close up hearing on Senate Bill 855, and we will, in fact, open the bill. Okay. We will, open the
and this, which one, Mr. Chair, before you move off, I want to make sure that
we didn't end it so that you can't open it this afternoon without a repost deal.
Okay. We will.
You may want to recess the public, reopen it and recess it until this afternoon.
Yeah. Reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 855, and we'll recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 855 until 5 p.m. this afternoon. Thank you for that help. We're going to open a... which one are we going next? Yeah, is Representative Logan available? We will... Representative Logan has been here to testify on House Bill 3455.
Well, we've
heard about it.
He's underway.
Thank you.
Is there amendments to this bill, Mr. Chair?
Is there any changes or amendments?
I don't know why that is. I'm not sure.
Is it?
Did you include this under fire? I don't know why we don't just move it.
Why don't we...
We
need to... Okay. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3455 and ask Greg Green from DEQ to come and tell us why this is a good public policy.
We need money, or are we? And I'm sure the public is fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Courtney. Once again, my name is Greg Green. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for DEQ. We're not going to oppose this bill, and I realize that you have a time consideration, so I'll try to offer my testimony fairly quickly. DEQ doesn't oppose improving customer service. As a matter of fact, the last couple of years, we've started programs where we offer appointments to our customers coming in to get their cars inspected. We offer directions to the nearest stations. We offer advice to the customers on the best days to visit the stations. We give them a list of certified mechanics for those whose cars do fail. We've trained mechanics who know how to read the information. We give them and fix the car more efficiently and at better cost levels. And we've established staffing levels in our stations that keep wait times, hopefully keep waiting times down to a minimum of 15 minutes or a maximum of 15 minutes. Also, our stations are open 6 days a week, 9 to 10 hours a day. So we think that all of our customers do have the opportunity to come and visit, get the cars inspected when they need to. We are willing to shift the hours of our stations to keep them open at least one day a week each station until 9 o'clock at night. Our only concern with this bill, aside from the fact that it probably could have been handled with a simple phone call, is that if the bill doesn't give us an out, and we've tried in the past to keep the stations open until 9 o'clock at night and just didn't get the customer service levels that we needed to financially justify it. I have talked to Senator Representative Logan about that, and she has agreed to try to establish a mechanism where we can come back in 18 months or so and report on the status of keeping the hours open later. And if it just isn't working, then we could try to figure out a way then to correct that. So with that being said, we are going to go ahead and move forward with this program, whether the bill passes or not. And starting September 1st, we will keep the stations open at least one night a week until 9 o'clock.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney.
Move House Bill 3455 and go to floor to pass.
We got to get out of the public hearing mode and get into work session before we can do that. Is that all right with Senator or Representative Logan?
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. And yes, this is our wish to go forward with this bill and to give it enough time to really work. Any new program takes time for people to get used to it. So I'm not eager to have a 6 month review. I'm eager to have something in about 18 months to 2 years that will give this program
time to get known and used, and we don't want to set it up to fail. We want to set it up to succeed and get some good word out from DEQ stations as to what they're doing and let the public know, and I think it'll be a good user-friendly procedure for the public.
Thank you very much. So that was the public hearing.
Move out to official 55 acres.
From the working session on 3455, Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 3455 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
He's not the emergency clause on this, so I can't. We need to go to the effect.
Thank you. And clerk, call the roll.
Hi.
Hi. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 3455 is moved towards due pass recommendation. Chair will carry. Close the work session on 3455 and open a work session on House Bill 2637. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2637.
For the record, my name is Greg Green. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for DEQ. This bill is a lot more problematic for the department, and we do, in fact, oppose the bill. Back during the late 1970s, early 1980s, the Portland region, which includes most of Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County, violated the air quality standard an average of once every 3 days. And because of those violations of the federal air quality standard, the EPA formally designated the region what's called non-attainment status. And when a region is designated non-attainment status, what happens primarily is
wish to go forward with this bill and to give it enough time to really work. Any new program takes time for people to get used to it. So I'm not eager to have a 6 month review. I'm eager to have something in about 18 months to deliver that will give this program time to get known and used. And we don't want to set it up to fail. We want to set it up to succeed and get the word out from DEQ stations as to what they're doing and let the public know, and I think it'll be a good user-friendly procedure for the public.
Thank you very much. So that was the public hearing.
We'll go to the public hearing
on the working session on 3455. Senator Clinton has moved now to 3465 to the floor of the new class recommendation. Any further discussion? Please let me go next to the floor of the next room.
We need to go to the effect.
Thank you. And clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
I received enough for the majority. I'll say 3465 is moved for the past recommendation. Sure, let's carry. Let's see, let's place on 3455 and open the work session on House Bill 2637. Open up. Public hearing on House Bill 2637.
Load in the Portland airshed.
Central Star, when we determine which areas to include into the inspection boundary, what we did is we asked the question, if the vehicle doesn't commute under the Portland airshed, why should it affect the pollution load in the Portland airshed? Mr. Chair, it doesn't. The problem is we don't have a mechanism to identify which vehicles don't commute into the airshed.
This bill gives you a mechanism.
It's not an Senator Starr, it's not an enforcement mechanism that we can enforce. This bill doesn't give us the authority to enforce that, and it doesn't give us the money nor the means to enforce it. So simply what we're doing is taking people's word that they're not commuting into the ocean.
People's word used to be accepted pretty generally in this country.
Excuse me.
Say goodbye.
Can you think of any ways, Mr. Green, that there could be a mechanism that would make this work? Mr. Chair, thank you, we have, in fact, over the past 4 years, offered a couple of mechanisms. One, for instance, could be where we would give people who certify that they didn't commute into the airstream a particular sticker that they could put on their car, so that, for instance, if they did come into the airstream and a car with that sticker was seen on it, we could then take some type of action. But the problem is this bill doesn't give us the authority nor the money to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Black, in 97 we apparently passed a similar bill and vetoed by the governor, and in his veto method there was supposed to be an interim study by the department to look at hardship and fairness issues. And I have a letter here from the city recruiter that said basically that the commission didn't do anything in that regard or didn't have any suggestions. Do you wish to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryan, we did in fact do a study, and what we found out at that time is that the law allows us to exempt classes of vehicle, but it doesn't allow us to exempt classes of people. And so what we did is if we did establish a hardship program for low-income drivers to allow them to take a less stringent program and keep the cost of complying with the program down for them. And then we also identified a couple of other strategies, such as the one I just mentioned, where we could offer special stickers for cars. But once again, those were rejected because there isn't money available to implement those strategies.
One final question, though. What was considered commuting? I mean, if you take your farm truck into the city or through the area once every 10 days, that wouldn't be considered commuting, was it? My sense is the intent is those that come on almost a daily basis or 5 days out of the week into the Portland area are the ones that should have to comply. Is that a fair understanding? Is that defined in the rules somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryan, that's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, the existing statute does exempt farm vehicles. That's the only class of vehicles it does specifically exempt. When we determine which areas to include in the expanded boundary, we actually looked at commuting rates for those people who actually work in the airshed, and we established a minimum level of 40%. But in fact, there is a great deal of commuting into the airshed beyond that, but for purposes of establishing the level, we went stricter for those people who actually work into the airshed.
Mr. Chair?
See if I understand this correctly. If the legislature provided you the means to set up a certification program that would allow people who did not commute in to come to one of these stations or DQ office and certify in writing that they were not a commuter into the Portland area and would put a sticker on their car, that you, the department, would be comfortable with that kind of an option?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryan, that's absolutely correct. There's two options we could be comfortable with. One, if they provided us resources to enforce this program, or secondly, if the bill would identify other sources that we could go to for a like amount of pollution reduction credits. For instance, to go tighten up on industry a little bit more or something like that.
You're confusing me. We just talked about someone could come in and say, I'm not going to commute, get some form of a sticker and put it on their vehicle.
what's the cost, magnitude of the cost to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryan, I don't have a cost figure, but basically what it would involve is administering the program, working with DMV to develop the sticker, the cost of the sticker itself, and then working with the local law enforcement jurisdictions to watch for the sticker.
That's basically the minimal cost.
Any further questions? We have Jeff Watkins and Hillary.
How do you say that?
Abraham. Leslie Lewis first, though. Leslie has come all the way from the House, and she is representing Yamhill County.
I testified previously. Star. Perhaps allow these other people to testify.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. If I may, I don't want to take up Mr. Lewis' time unnecessarily. Did you hear the discussion we just had about the alternative permit?
Not all of it. Well, in fact, I heard very little of it. You want to recap it for me?
Well, Mr. Green suggested that would be acceptable to DEQ is if the legislature provided the department with the authority, and it sounds like a minimal amount of funds, to provide an opportunity for people who were not commuters into the Tri-County airshed to go to a DMV office or DEQ office, I'm not sure that, and just sign something that says, I don't commute into the airshed, and get a sticker, that would be an acceptable alternative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I guess I should introduce myself for the record. Leslie Lewis, State Representative for District 29, and a staff answer. Did I call you Representative? I apologize. Senator Starr, Senator Byer, to answer your questions, we have actually last session when DEQ worked with us on this bill, and actually the language that you see in the bill is DEQ's language that we worked on with them last session, and we simply changed the sunset date is all we did in reintroducing it this session. There is a mechanism now, and I think I mentioned this in my testimony last week or whenever this bill was up last. In Yamhill County right now, when they send out the mailing goes to everybody who's in the 97132 zip code. It's one of the zip codes. Well, there's about 17,000 people in the city of Newburgh who are in that zip code. I don't know how many cars that would represent. That are not in the testing area at all, because the city of Newburgh is not in the testing. So they already have a mechanism on the DMV form to put a little check mark to say, I don't live in the inspection area. And this was something that we had proposed to them 2 years ago, that we could simply add another line that says, I don't commute to Portland, and they would have to indicate who their who their employer was, or they'd have to indicate that they were retired, something like that to indicate that they truly were not commuters. So that, yes, that idea has been out there for 2 years, and last year, or 2 years ago, DEQ was willing to work with us on that idea. And you could, when you mailed back the person, DMV, when they mailed back the license to that the car registration to that individual, they could include a sticker. That could be done.
Pretty simple. But I don't think they have the authority in the bill to do that. The it seems like it might be an amendment that was
yes, it says in sub 3 of section 1, Environmental Quality Commission shall establish by rule any procedure necessary to implement this section. I think that they could do that with that rule.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, see, they've already done that, again, for the vast, there are very few people in my county who are actually in the testing, and yet there's these 17,000 people in the city of Newburgh who get the notice, who are not in the testing, and they just simply put I mean, they did this simply without any legislation. They just put a little place on there for them to put a check mark to say, I don't live in the inspection area. It's still a problem in our district, and we've tried to work with DEQ and DMV to have them not mail to these people because it just upsets them. You know, I mean, they upset the entire city of Newburgh, and I've been working on that for 4 years, and I would tell you that while they talked about cooperation up here, they have not been very cooperative and very helpful in helping us resolve that issue. But there is, in fact, you know, they did that by rule when they established the testing. So that was very simply, very easily done without any legislation. As I said, there's already a little check mark placed on the registration. The license renewal. And Mr. Chair, if I would add to Senator Beyer, last session when we worked on this bill together, they didn't feel they needed anything other than the language that was in the bill. And they supported the bill all the way through last time. And for some reason this session they're having a different attitude, and I'm not quite understanding that myself.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
Yes, Mr. Green, come back up to address that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byron, thank you. The reason we're especially reluctant to support the bill this time is because last summer the Portland region exceeded the air quality standard 4 times. And so what that tells us that even with the strategies that we have in place, there's a high likelihood that we could have another problem in the very near future. And if we do, it becomes an economic issue, and it affects new industry and existing industries very, very hard financially. So that if we do take the chance of exempting commuters into the airshed who are contributing to the problem, then we're walking a very fine line already, and in my mind, we're not protecting the airshed from unhealthy levels of air.
Mr. Green, I don't think we're talking about, at least I don't hear Representative Lewis saying her intent is to exempt commuters into the airshed. She's suggesting, I believe, I'll say this, that commuters into the airshed should indeed get their emission things, but we're talking about people who don't come into the airshed.
Correct.
Which I said to you, and she implies that you have the authority in statute, at least in this bill, to specify that process she described a few minutes ago to me by administrative rule. You indicated that you needed additional statutory authority, and I believe you talked about some penalty, and I'm wondering if you could you point out what additional you would need that you think isn't in the bill to be able to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byron, money. We need the money to implement and enforce the program. It takes money to print the stickers. It takes money to do the administrative work through DMV, and it takes money to work with the local law enforcement agencies to identify these vehicles and take action. Yeah.
Are you saying that there's a sufficient language here to be able to adopt the rules to enforce a program that you find is acceptable? That what's missing is an appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes.
Mr. Chair, you know, one option would be that we can address this when we work on DEQ's budget, which has yet to come to work session in the Ways and Means process. And we can address this when we work their budget. I would need to look at how much they already have in the air quality program, and I think we'd need to, some information from DEQ on what they believe the fiscal would be on this. But I believe we can work on that in the budget process.
I would suggest it's a little uncomfortable dealing with it if we have a fiscal impact that shows indeed a deduction from the current level of spending. Mr. Green is suggesting that if it's an increased level of spending, it should be like shooting blind. This is a Senator Courtney's favorite kind of activity.
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen the fiscal.
Fiscal is a reduction of inspection fees.
Later on.
A little less than $250,000.
Certainly, if you're not inspecting the vehicle, you don't collect fees. And
that's true, but if you have hiring by not collecting the fees or not doing the inspections, you have a higher cost in another way.
Should not materially affect.
What the department is saying, though, Mr. Chair.
They're
saying they can't operate. What I hear is saying they're not.
Oh, yeah. I understand what they're saying, that they need to, be dealt with.
Well, Mr. Chair, if it would make the committee feel more comfortable, if the bill could be moved to Ways and Means, then we could attach the appropriate dollars to the bill.
I accept the company's We've got two other witnesses. We're running short of time, but I want to accommodate the witnesses and make it brief. Jeff Watkins and Hillary Abraham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I will be brief. Just briefly, I wanted to just tell you a little bit about Sierra Club.
We're acquainted with Sierra Club.
Okay.
I want to know what you are addressing the bill.
Okay.
Please.
No problem. Please. We're opposed to House Bill 2637, and I think that you've heard a lot of testimony on the bill, and I will be the first 2 minutes. It's a very tough issue. I just want to make two quick points. I think acknowledging all the inconveniences and costs and inequities and whatnot in the program, I think you need to be real careful about what the solution is. And the problem isn't very pretty, and I don't think the solutions are either. So I'm having trouble being comforted by the proposed solutions and the stickers and things like that. Those are all going to be expensive and difficult to administer as well. But the major point I'd like to make is that I get to take exception to the statement that cars in Yamhill or Columbia County don't contribute to air pollution in Portland or other areas. The emissions from autos are a significant source of nitrogen oxide, soot, and volatile organic compounds. And these pollutants are harmful to people, vegetation, and wildlife. And these substances do travel great distances. So, you know, is Newburgh in Portland? No. But, you know, the emissions do travel. So that's our main objection is that we feel that would weaken that. So, okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council. The testimony that's been passed out to you is from Chris Hagerbaumer, our Air and Transportation Director, who is not able to be here today. I will also be brief. The OEC is also opposed to House Bill 2637 for many of the reasons that you've heard today. All that all really emphasizes our desire to ensure that our quality standards continue to be in compliance with the federal air quality standards for ozone. And we have some concern that while vehicles that are driven primarily outside of the maintenance area certainly pose less of a threat to the region's air quality than vehicles that are driven inside the boundary, the fact remains that ozone does travel great distances. Emissions from vehicles driven in Scappoose, for example, can contribute to ozone exceedances in Oregon City.
Excuse me. If the ozone, with the contaminants traveling, we never have a problem with pollution levels. It's when we have air stagnation and no movement that we have pollution problems. So to suggest that because it moves that we need to deal with this is disingenuous to the problem. The problem, in fact, is when there is no air movement, we have inversions or we have situations where the pollutant is held in the area and not being blown out of the area. That's the only time when we have a problem. So to me, this idea that that we get cross contamination is doesn't address the issue at all.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I actually, as I said, this is testimony of Chris Niederbalmer. I'm not an air quality expert, but my understanding is that there is some evidence that suggests that ozone and smog and particulates contained in the air actually do travel. But I don't have any specific data or scientific research that I can refer to.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to close the public hearing and suggest that we move the bill to Ways and Means.
Any work session?
Open a work session on House Bill 2637.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2637 without recommendation to Ways and Means.
Part of ours moved House Bill 2637 without recommendation to Ways and Means. Discussion?
I'll support it. I would support the bill too, but it's Ways and Means. I'll support the motion.
Mr. Chair, mine, just listening to it, I think we've heard DEQ say that they essentially see this as a financial problem. Their ability to administer it, that's an issue we can't deal with. Ways and Means can. The co-chair, one of the co-chairs, is here and says she'll deal with it. Let's let them deal with it.
Call the roll.
Senator
Byrd?
Aye.
Senator Bryant?
Aye.
Senator Cordy?
Yes.
Senator
Starr? Aye. That is the necessary majority. House Bill 2637 is moved to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lewis. Close the work session. And we'll open a... open a public hearing on House Bill 3541. And we have the Representative Ross is not available. Didn't testify. There he is. Representative Welch.
Chair Starr, committee members, I'm representing Jim Welch from District 43, Elmira, Oregon. Quickly just introduce this bill to you. It has been amended. We did that in House Water Environment, where the bill comes from. I think the most important section of this, of course, is the under Section 1. We have a lot of whereases in there that talk about Kyoto Protocol. But what this particular bill does is refer to Kyoto Protocol, and what we were concerned about, and a lot of states were, is the overimportance of the Kyoto Protocol coming from the treaty, and certainly an administration that signed on to it, but not ratified by the Senate, and we're talking about the U.S. Senate. And the impact it could have if the EPA starts putting a lot of pressure on states to abide by a certain amount of regulations around air control, air pollution control. And it would cost us in a number of different sectors in the state and across the nation billions of dollars to adjust to this very possible.
Without recommendation to Ways and Means.
Part of ours moved House Bill 2637 without recommendation to Ways and Means. Discussion?
I'll support it. I would support the bill too, but it's Ways and Means. I'll support the motion.
Just about what you said. Mine, just listening to it, I think we've heard DEQ say that they essentially see this as a financial problem. administrator. The ability to administer, that's an issue we can't deal with. Ways and means can. The co-chair, one of the co-chairs, is here to say she'll deal with it. She'll deal with it.
That's part of it.
What do you
got?
Hi.
Hi. Yes. Hi. I received the necessary and ready help for 2637 inclusive ways and means.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Lewis. Okay, for this question. And we'll open the open a public hearing on House Bill 3531. And we have the representative left is not there. I didn't tell the time. There he is.
Representative Welch.
Chair Starr, committee members, I'm representing Jim Welch from District 43, Elmira, Oregon. Quickly just introduce this bill to you. It has been amended. We did that in House Water Environment, where the bill comes from. I think the most important section of this, of course, is the under Section 1. We have a lot of whereases in there that talk about Kyoto Protocol. But what this particular bill does is refer to the Kyoto Protocol, and what we were concerned about, and a lot of states were, is the overimportance of the Kyoto Protocol coming from the treaty, and certainly an administration that signed on to it but not ratified by the Senate, and we're talking about the U.S. Senate. And the impact it could have that the EPA starts putting a lot of pressure on states to abide by certain amount of regulations around air control, air pollution control. And it would cost us in a number of different sectors in the state and across the nation billions of dollars to adjust to this very possibly if we're required to do that. And I'm saying we should not do that until the Senate ratifies that. But what we've done is really unique and important in the state of Oregon, being able to adjust as we see as necessary. We did establish, and I was on a task force in 95 on energy facility siting, and we, out of 50 states, the first to have a standard on CO2. But we established that through a long, involved process. The legislature had given us direction, the governor had given us direction to have a task force. And we did that knowing full and well what it would mean for energy facility siting. But we don't like to adjust to federal mandates, especially when we don't get congressional ratification. And that's all this is saying. You see in under Section 1 here, Sub 2, except as provided in ORS 469501 and 503 there, that refers to our statute on energy facility siting and what we have done as far as emission control is concerned. And we certainly don't want to overturn that, and we provided the necessary, or the Department of Energy did, gave us necessary language here for the amendment, and we included that. But what we're saying is the state agency may not adopt any rule or standard affecting the residential, commercial, industrial, electric, utility, transportation, agriculture, energy or mining sectors that reduces greenhouse gas emissions in order to implement Kyoto Protocol, and that's important to note there. We're just referring to that. But in sub 3, nothing in this section shall be construed to limit or impede voluntary initiatives to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases or prevent compliance with federal emission standards for greenhouse gases. And certainly, as we have always taken very seriously our environmental protection in the state of Oregon, what we don't want to do, though, is to go beyond and start adjusting and costing taxpayer dollars here in the state to adjust to pressure from the EPA when we do not have ratification of the U.S. Congress. And certainly that would be the Senate.
And what I've provided to committee members is the impact. There's been a lot written, a lot of studies done, a lot of data out there on what it cost, would cost us in all these sectors here that's provided in SF2. And this is just one of them. We talk about agriculture, and that's a big sector in this state. And it really does contribute a lot to our economic well-being in the state of Oregon. So it's important here, and what I used on the floor is for a floor testimony. It was just kind of a small capture of what this larger article is all about here, and what it would cost, very possibly cost, agriculture across this nation. And that ends my testimony. Chair Starr.
Just one question. I received a bunch of mail that probably should have been directed at me. It was apparently when this was on the House floor and there was a minority report, and they were encouraging me to vote in favor of the House minority report, which is difficult to do from the Senate. So I'm sure it was more or less a form letter that was sent to senator representatives, and they sent it to the senator too. What was the intent of the minority report?
All it did was direct the Office of Energy to conduct a study to identify the specific actions the state can take in collaboration with private business to help offset, mitigate, or directly reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases in Oregon.
Any further questions? We have Tom Novick, Jeff Watkins, Hillary Abraham.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Tom Novick, today representing the Renewable Northwest Project from the National Environmental Trust. NET is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that educates the public on environmental issues. The Renewable Northwest Project is a regional organization made up of alternative energy developers from solar, wind, geothermal, and environmental organizations, and that's active in the Northwest. We're here today to oppose House Bill 3541. For the following three reasons. Number one, we believe that global warming is recognized as a major problem, and Oregon, in fact, has taken the lead in many areas. The preamble to the bill paints a dire picture under the proposed Kyoto Protocol. Massive job losses, sharply increased energy prices, reduced family income wages are among the consequences cited for a treaty that I would point out is still in negotiation. These predictions rely on discredited analyses to conclude that Oregon should do nothing to find more ways for business, communities, and governments to take proactive efforts in our state. It's clear that global warming is a problem. Over 1,500 senior scientists from around the world, including 102 Nobel Prize winners, have declared in their World Scientist Call to Action that global warming is a real and serious threat. More than 2,000 leading economists have said that climate change poses significant economic and social risk. More importantly, I think, if you look at the pamphlet that was just passed out, major companies, including Enron, British Petroleum, Shell Oil, Boeing, DuPont, Weyerhaeuser, and Whirlpool, concur and have urged early preventative action by the industrialized nations. The United Nations is responsible for 1/4 of all global warming gases emitted. So we tend to think that Oregon does a good job, but in fact, we produce as much as 52 small developing countries that have a total population of over 250 million versus our 3 million. And Oregon as a state also emits more carbon dioxide per capita than Mexico, Argentina, China, Brazil, or India. Many studies have been done, the University of Washington, Pacific Northwest Labs, and others that show that the impacts of global warming in Oregon could be serious. I want to touch on one thing. Representative Welch pointed out the potential impact on agriculture. It's timely because just 2 weeks ago, the United States Department of Agriculture released a report entitled The Economic Analysis of U.S. Agriculture and the Kyoto Protocol. And one of the studies they critiqued was the one that was handed to you, which I believe was done by the American Farm Bureau. The USDA report disputes the scenarios like those detailed. It calls the analysis utilized to draw those conclusions flawed, and leading to alarmist conclusions based on energy price increases that are not based in reality. The report concludes that cost to U.S. farmers to comply with the Kyoto Treaty would be negligible. So global warming is a problem, and it does affect Oregon. But I think our second major point is, more importantly, we've shown that as a state, we can take actions without waiting for the federal government to tell us to curb global warming. HB 3541 would cede those decisions to the federal government. In essence, it says, wait until the feds tell us when and how and in what manner Oregon will deal with global warming. This is diametrically opposed to the approach that we have taken for over the last decade in the state. We've got a history of developing consensus and collaborative solutions to global warming concerns. This bill would imply that those efforts were not fruitful. Our approach has shown that there are ready, inexpensive solutions that we can take as a state government in collaboration with business and government. A couple of those examples, the Oregon Business Tax Credit, helps Oregon business reduce energy use, lower costs, and be less reliant on energy resources. In 1989, this legislature directed the state then Department of Energy to study ways that Oregon could cost-effectively reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and consequently, we've implemented many of those. The city of Portland has saved over $1.2 million since 1990 because of their early actions. I do want to touch on one because I think it shows what we've been able to do in Oregon. In 1997, the legislature embedded into the reform of Oregon siting rules measures to reduce carbon dioxide. It made us the first state in the country to have a carbon dioxide standard. That bill passed unanimously with each member of this committee voting for it as a member of the legislature. As I said, made us the first state with a CO2 standard. It was typical of the approach we've taken. It was supported by utilities, was supported by the environmental community, and was supported by state regulators. Three power plants which will compete in the deregulating electricity market have been cited in Oregon with significant CO2 mitigation requirements, even though we're the only state in the country with them. House Bill 3541 would discourage these types of efforts. A small state like Oregon can provide significant leadership on issues like global warming. We've shown that. Early positioning can provide strong economic protection. Our consistent investment in energy conservation has helped us maintain low electricity rates and avoid the building of new power plants. Our siting law anticipates the future and ensures that Oregon will benefit. We need to be in touch with the leading scientific and business thinking to look for ways to step forward on this issue in our interest and in our own terms, not those dictated by Congress. House Bill 3541 sends the message that we should do nothing until we're told. Finally, the last reason that we're opposed to this bill is its implications are unclear and we believe unnecessary. It says that no state agency can pass a regulation in order to implement the Kyoto protocol. It's unclear what this means to us. We're hard-pressed to concoct any scenario where a state agency would adopt rules to implement an international treaty not yet signed. In fact, know of no previous instances in the history of Oregon where this has happened. If the legislature directs a state agency to implement new rules on greenhouse gases, and they happen to resemble part of the Kyoto Protocol, does that mean it's then challengeable legally? Or, opposite, does it have to specifically say that this regulation is being implemented to implement the Kyoto Protocol? If that's the case, then the law is either, one, meaningless, or two, on the other hand, sends a chilling effect to agencies wondering if potential actions that they take after they've been directed would be challenged. Finally, we think this bill sends the wrong message to businesses, government agencies, and others in Oregon about global warming. As I said, it tells us to wait and see if the federal government ratifies an international treaty before we do anything to deal with global warming. It's diametrically opposed to the approach we've taken. It says don't develop solutions that work for us in Oregon, and we believe this is the wrong approach. Thank you. Questions?
Okay, sure. The examples you cite of good programs all had to go through the legislature, and from the tax credit to the others. So this bill wouldn't affect that, because if DEQ or citizens or business want to present an idea to the legislature, they're free to do that, and it can be adopted. All it seems to do is say agencies don't go out on your own without legislative approval. And if the agency wants to do something, they certainly can come and ask the
the legislation come through, but which to me would be the appropriate thing to do. Voluntary things can, of course, still be done, but the good examples you cited and that I supported all had to have legislative action, so I don't see this bill having that impact, except if an agency wanted to go off on their own and do something the legislature hadn't already approved.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryant, that did get to my third point, which is it's not clear what impact, if any, this legislation would have. As I said, we've searched back through the annals and have never found an instance where an agency went to implement a rule on an international treaty that had not yet been ratified. Putting that aside, the rest of the bill does end up in statute, and it, we believe it sets the wrong tone. I agree with you that, in fact, the legislature has worked on those programs. We think they've been good programs. We don't see this bill as needed or having an impact other than putting into our statutes a number of potential, when you read the preamble to the bill, a number of potential disputable claims on what global warming would do.
Other questions?
Thank you. Make your testimony brief. We've got it only a few moments.
Yes, I will. Chair Star, members of the Washington Woods Sierra Club. And just a couple quick things. For global warming for Oregon would have a big impact in particular on Oregon because Oregon's economy is based on agriculture and forestry. They're some of the most important things. And both of these industries are sensitive to changes in temperature and precipitation. In addition, sea level rises could affect coastal areas, which Oregon obviously has a lot of. Again, it's noteworthy that some very big corporations, transnational corporations, have stepped up and said, hey, this is a problem, and we do need to do something about it. And just some examples are British Petroleum, Shell Oil, Enron, and Toyota.
We've had that test.
Okay. One of the arguments I hear against the Kyoto Protocol is that it will put the U.S. at a disadvantage because some other countries are wavering or not willing to sign it. And just two quick points on that. One is that the United States is the leader in producing emissions, greenhouse emissions. So, therefore, the person who's causing the biggest problem should be taking a leadership role. And the other is the competitive disadvantage argument. I'm not sure we want to. I don't know if any of you have been to Asia or Mexico or Russia or any of those places, but if we have the same environmental rules that they do to be competitive with them, I think we're all in a lot of trouble. Fortunately, I think the U.S. can and Oregon can do some things that improve our economy and create jobs without breaking the bank. Just some quick examples are promotion of clean energy generation, cleaner burning cars, greater fuel efficiency, and the use of renewable energy. Just this will take 1 second. Sure. This first thing that I gave you, the heat wave, I just wanted to bring your attention to the graph on page 2. And the red line is the concentration of CO2, carbon dioxide. And the orange line is the temperature. And you can see, I'm not a scientist, but if you look at that, it still said there's a correlation there between greenhouse emissions and global temperature. The second thing, which has CAFE on the top, the very last sentence of the paragraph there just talks about how we are the largest emitter of CO2. And it gives some examples of what are the sources of that and some examples of how just modest tweaks and improvements and fuel efficiency for autos and emission standards can really do a lot. So we're not talking about breaking the bank here. And finally, just a quick thing on, besides auto, the other major sources are coal and oil generated power. And so just some modest improvements on making those a little bit cleaner and maybe shifting to some other energy sources would also make a big difference in global warming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council. I will be very brief. I just would like to echo many of the same comments that my colleagues have made today. Clearly, global warming is here now, and increased greenhouse gas concentration from human activities are driving that warming. I would just add that our perspective is that House Bill 3541 actually exaggerates the cost of climate change measures. The cost estimates stated as fact in the preamble are, in fact, just one set of estimates from one study evaluating one possible scenario for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We believe that if we try to control greenhouse gas emissions through command and control regulations, it may be indeed expensive, as some industries claim, though still cheaper than coping with dramatic climate changes. And finally, we believe this bill will prohibit common sense policies. This bill will confuse, delay, or possibly even prevent a host of common sense measures, which may prohibit Oregon from creating pollution reduction pollution reduction facilities and things like that. So for these reasons and others that have been stated today, we oppose the bill.
Thank you. We're going to not try to take action on this bill now. I comment the global warming is not at all clear. Many credible scientists disagree totally with the Kyoto protocols, as you're well aware. I am, as a plant scientist, I understand that by raising the CO2 level, we increase crop production, and that that's a very beneficial use of CO2. Without it, we don't raise crops of any kind. And I just have serious problems with scientists who, regardless of their numbers, go off and say this is a certainty, when there's many who say this is not in any way a certainty. And so I'd like to leave a debate in the scientific community, and we'll probably bring this bill back when we have our full membership available in a work session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3241. We have less than 5 minutes. We have some witnesses. Roger Hamilton and Shelley.
Sure, we're coming forward. Tonight we meet at 5 o'clock.
That's right.
Senator Courtney and I could still be in judiciary at that time, but we're only a doorway, and so we'll join you as soon as we can.
All right. Appreciate that. Perhaps I didn't close the public hearing on House Bill 3541. I will do that, and the public hearing, as I said, on House Bill 3241. Please
Chair Starr, members of the committee, in the flesh, you feel first or so to go. I'll just be very brief. Roger Hamilton from the Public Utility Commission. We spoke to this bill on Monday. We've offered an amendment, and I think you all have copies of this, that basically streamlines the report, an annual report. This is our main concern. We've conceded that it might be appropriate to raise the limit to $100,000 from $25,000 for the affiliated interest prior approval requirement that we formerly had. This would simply require a very simple report, really so simple that we think it could be characterized as a list that states the names of the parties to the contracts, the amount of the contracts, the date of execution, the pricing method utilized, whether it's a market price or a cost plus rate of return, regulatory asset price,
And the nature of goods and services provided in the case of GTE or US West, these are usually either data processing services or vehicle leasing services, I think, in the case of GTE or property leases. And then with that streamlined report, we would at least not be totally in the dark as to what kinds of transactions were going on that were affiliated interest transactions between the amounts of $25,000 and $100,000. And I didn't mention last Monday that one of the reasons this is particularly important to us with respect to GTE is that their affiliate expenses do constitute about 43% of their total operating expenses or have in the past.
Thank you. You're speaking to the Dastri Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Speaking, Chair Starr, to amendments that I provided to the committee, just committee members just prior to this hearing, they're not, they have not gone through legislative drafting. They simply read amendments to HB 3241-A. They would also delete what we think is a conflict, which would eliminate any reporting requirement, which is in conflict with reporting requirements for rate reviews in other statutes.
Okay.
Chair Starr, committee members, I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Legislative Affairs Manager for GTE. We have proposed the Dash 3 amendments. The main difference between what the commission proposes and ours is the, I don't have theirs in front of me, but it's the pricing information and the goods and services. I need to point out that this list, the only contracts that the commission would not have previously had before them are contracts that are less, that are $100,000 or less. So we don't really see the point in having to provide more detailed information because anything that's over $100,000, the commission will have already had the actual contract to review. This was mainly to address their issue that we could be entering into contracts that they would never know anything about. Also, as to their point on deleting lines 6 through 8 on page 3, I think on that one we just have a fundamental difference. We had asked the Ledge Council to draft that language to eliminate the report that's in the rules. Several attorneys at GTE have looked at that and don't believe that it does have any effect on the Commission's ability to look more further into contracts as part of a rate case. It simply says that as part of this affiliate transaction section, they cannot require additional reporting. We'd ask that you adopt the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments.
Yes, sir. We know this.
We are not. I would. Senator Barr.
To be clear, Shelley, have you seen the PUC's?
I saw it at 7 o'clock last night. I sent ours to them, and theirs were changes to ours.
And you find theirs to be unacceptable?
We prefer what we had listed, and part of the reason is because the whole purpose of this bill is to reduce the paperwork required. This is the report we currently file annually, and we felt that our amendments, which required a list of the contracts, the names of the parties, the dollar amounts of the contracts, and the date of execution, should address the issue of making sure that the PUC was aware of all contracts. Again, anything over $100,000, they would have the actual contract, so they would know what the purpose of the contract was, what the methodology for pricing was. And again, they can, when it comes to a rate case and adjusting our rates based on the contracts that they find acceptable or unacceptable, they can still do all of that in a rate case.
Senator Barr.
Roger, they seem very close. What's the substantial difference between the Dash 3s and the PUC proposal in your mind?
Yes, Senator Barr, Mr. Chair, simply that there would be some report required, and in my estimation, would not be very burdensome. GTE had one filing that would have fallen under this requirement, 25,000 to 100,000 in 98, 3 in 97, and 1 in 96. The report we're requiring could be done on about a half a page. The report we're suggesting.
What are you addressing? Are you addressing?
I'm addressing
paragraph in yours.
Yes.
How do you see that as substantially different from sub 2 on the A3s? I mean, it seems like theirs talks about providing a list of all the same contracts. The only thing that seems to be different is yours requires the.
Also, as to their point on deleting lines 6 through 8 on page 3, I think on that one we just have a fundamental difference. We had asked the Ledge Council to draft that language to eliminate the report that's in the rules. Several attorneys at DCE have looked at that and don't believe that it does have any effect on the Commission's ability to look more further into contracts as part of a rate case. It simply says that as part of this affiliate transaction section, they cannot require additional reporting. We'd ask that you adopt the dash 2 and dash 3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, are we in recess?
We are not. I would start the bar.
To be clear, Shelley, have you seen the PUC's?
Yeah, I saw it at 7 o'clock last night. I'd sent ours to them, and theirs were changes to ours.
And you find theirs to be unacceptable?
We prefer what we had listed, and part of the reason is because the whole purpose of this bill is to reduce the paperwork required. This is the report we currently file annually, and we felt that our amendments, which required a list of the contracts, the names of the parties, the dollar amounts of the contracts, and the date of execution, should address the issue of making sure that the PUC was aware of all contracts. Again, anything over $100,000, they would have the actual contract, so they would know what the purpose of the contract was, what the methodology for pricing was. And again, they can, when it comes to a rate case and adjusting our rates based on the contracts that they find acceptable or unacceptable, they can still do all of that in a rate case.
Roger, they seem very close. What's the substantial difference between the dash 3s and the PUC proposal in your mind?
Yes, Senator Barr, Mr. Chair, simply that there would be some report required, and in my estimation, would not be very burdensome. GTE had one filing that would have fallen under this requirement, 25,000 to 100,000 in 98, 3 in 97, and 1 in 96. The report we're requiring could be done on about a half a page. The report we're suggesting.
What are you addressing? Are you addressing?
I'm addressing
paragraph in yours.
Yes.
How do you see that as substantially different from sub 2 on the A3s? I mean, it seems like theirs talks about providing a list of all the same contracts. The only thing that seems to be different is yours requires the report on the pricing methods.
Yes, Senator Barr, can I have my staff person who actually reviews these contracts get into this level of detail, if I may?
Kristen. Thank you. Mike Myers, Commission staff. Chairman Starr, Senator Barr, what we're proposing is not very different from what the company has offered in their, I believe it's the DAS 3 amendments. As Shelley pointed out, we've added pricing method and the nature of goods or services. And what that allows us to do is to, at least on a preliminary basis, take a look and see if some of these contracts have been split up to avoid the 100,000 threshold, and in that way alerts us to potential problems that way. And Shelley was showing you the annual affiliate interest report that they file, and I'm sure that you can see, looking at that and then looking at what we propose, we're not talking about the same thing. We do not think that the amendment we propose today is burdensome whatsoever.
The difference is so minor. Be the chair's desire to go ahead and move the dash 2 and 3 amendments and move the bill.
We go to the work session. I'll do that, Mr. Chair.
Close public hearing from the work session on House Bill 3241.
Chair, I would move the dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3241.
Any objection?
I do.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Are you?
There's no objection in 2.
That's the calendar year one.
On the semi-annual.
That was the last. Senator Corbett, I'm confused. You're referring
to the NCA2 amendment.
Senator Bryant, you didn't have an objection to these, did you?
I do not believe you objected to these.
Yes. The problem remains, as I understand, the two amendments. So the dash, I don't have the dash. The dash 2 amendments delete the annual reporting requirement. We are asking for an annual report, but a very minimal annual report. And the difference here would be the inclusion of the pricing method utilized and the nature of goods or services provided, so that we could distinguish any kind of self-dealing that might be going on.
Well, sure. No objection,
sir. Trying to get clarity on this. You still would, even if the dash 3s are yours, you would still get an annual report. So the A2s really don't affect that.
That's correct.
With items or the A3s, you still get an annual report. So
that's correct.
Aaron, you say you don't have an objection to the...
Yes, that's correct. Now that
I don't have an objection to the...
Yeah, I don't object.
All right. Order.
Chair, I would then move the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 3241.
Senator Bryant has moved the dash 8-3 amendments. Any objection? Hearing none, so heard.
Chair, I move that House Bill 3241 has amended the sports with a 2-pass recommendation.
Senator Bryant has moved House Bill 3241 has amended the sports with a 2-pass recommendation. Clerk, call roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator
Bryant.
No.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Aye. I received the necessary majority.
House Bill 3241 moved forward to pass recommendation.
Sure, just a note for the record. My view on the dash 2 is that I didn't see a substantial difference between the two. And my concern was that the PUC continued to get a report that would give them amounts and contracts, and I think they get that out of it. I think it's methodology.
Sure, we'll carry. First session of the rules on election committee.
We're back to what's coming up.
And the issue that we need.